Welcome to Resiliency Redefined. I'm your host, Robin, and I am thrilled to share with you information about resiliency, well-being, performance, education, business, parenting, and everything in between. I'm committed to joining you each week to talk about these big ideas and bring them into action, habits, tools, strategies, tactics that allow us to finally uncover what it takes to truly be well. And I'm just so excited that you're here. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Resiliency Redefined. Today, I'm excited to jump in here to talk everything top of mind for me around International Women's Day, which we are celebrating in the month of March. I just got home from my first International Women's Day event from 2025. I had this amazing opportunity to work with Ford Canada and Ford Women in Canada. And oh my goodness, it is so refreshing to get around people who are excited to have these big conversations about women and our roles in occupational practice, but also just all across the board, like in our families, in our social settings, again, in occupation. I'm just so inspired right now hearing about these women who are doing the great work, and really just gave me pause just to, again, appreciate that. I know we think about this a lot around March with International Women's Day, and I just want to hold space to recognize like the each and every day efforts that go into women, especially, you know, the women that are just holding all these different roles and responsibilities. So I thought we can talk about that this for our time together today. And as always, I'm just so glad that you are here. Now, in full disclosure, I didn't know a lot about International Women's Day events before I started doing more public speaking. And what I mean by that is I've been very obviously present and cognizant about, you know, women's issues as a woman. I have navigated my fair share of kind of themes and areas of focus within this realm. I especially felt it working in different institutions where there are very different kind of attitudes and different ways that people treat women in the workplace, especially when women are in what we would consider non-traditional women roles. So again, I feel like I knew about International Women's Day, but definitely different where I would say my understanding of is it today than it was before. And I'm still learning. So by no means in our short time together can I cover all things International Women's Day, but I do just want to bring and kind of pull some threads around some things that really spoke to me today at that event at Ford, and also just overall things that I just think are quite curious. There's a lot of curiosity actually around some of this, and I'm curious to hear what your thoughts are on some of these ideas as well. So to kind of kick us off, I first want to like just hold space to recognize a woman by the name of Emily Baker happened to be the first woman to hold a doctoral degree in Canada in the year 1903. I'm sharing this because just the notion that women have been holding higher level degrees for all intents and purposes, such a short period of time, I think sometimes we lose awareness of the fact that some people, women, had to work so hard to be given essentially some basic opportunities that were already afforded to men. And the fact that doctoral degree holder in Canada was Emily Baker, and I don't know enough about her, but I imagine she has one heck of a story as to how she became the first woman to hold a doctoral degree in Canada. But as somebody who also has a doctoral degree, I just want to give my little shout out to Emily Baker for the work that she did as again, laying the foundation, this trailblazer who then made it possible for the other 113,000 women as of right now who hold doctoral degrees in Canada. So I think it's great to know our origins in the sense of who kind of knocked down that first door. And it was Emily Baker. So Emily, thank you. And another little shout out I think that's so important that I wanted to hold space for is to recognize the what's called the Famous Five. And I'm not sure how many people are familiar with the Famous Five and the pink tea parties. I remember teaching my social psych students about this. Those were second year social psychology students. And just how much, like, again, the fact that these five women got together, they're referred to as the famous five, and they were trying to push forward the agenda for women to be recognized. Are you ready for this? As people in Canada, as people. So before that, women were not actually recognized as people. So in 1927, these five women get together and they're going to figure out, okay, how are we going to get women to, like, how are we going to advocate for women to have rights to be perceived and recognized by law as people? And what they were doing in their suffragette movement, like during this whole time, what they realized is they couldn't just like call together this like little act of rebellion because people would obviously dismantle it. So what they started to do is they called it the Pink Tea Party. So they would get together to have pink tea, which everyone who was like in the know knew you came together for this pink tea, which was symbolic of we get together, we have quote tea, but really we're like getting ready to like burn the bridges. Like we're getting ready to advocate strongly for women. And remarkably, so I believe like they started, the first petition went in 1927, and it wasn't until 1929 that women were recognized as human beings, as people in the eye of the law. Again, this isn't that long ago. I appreciate we can sit there and be like, oh, Robin, that was 100 years ago. But yeah, but that's really not that long of a time ago, right? Like many of our grandmothers and our great grandmothers would have been born into a time when they weren't recognized as people within our own country. So when people kind of say, well, why are we having to have these International Women's Day events? I think this is one of the reasons. We need to educate ourselves about recognizing all of the opportunities that we are now afforded in 2025 that historically people had to fight really hard for us to be able to have these opportunities. A couple other little kind of notes. This is what I always find fascinating is the fact that it wasn't until 1960 that all women in Canada were eligible to vote. Again, that is not that long ago that women actually had a say. And you might be thinking like, oh, Robin, this is like old news. This is old stuff. I get that. But what about this? Women weren't even allowed to have a credit card until 1974. Women couldn't have debt. They only were able to have debt in a mortgage if their male partner co-signed for them. Women were not allowed on their own to have a mortgage or to have a credit card. So my gentle invitation, when you use your credit cards this month, women, I want you to just like, yes, yes, I will. Use those credit cards and just have a little bit of a moment of recognition that it wasn't that long ago that women were allowed to actually have their own credit card. So I think every little act of using it and then paying it off in a reasonable time is a sign of solidarity with the people who made all of this possible. Okay, this is not by any means meant to be a history lesson in all things women's rights in Canada, but one of the things that I think it's helpful to keep in mind, as all of these amazing advancements for women's rights were evolving and processing and happening, I think there was like a wee bit of a fumble. And what I mean by that, this wee bit of a fumble was as they were adding rights and opportunities and forging and fighting for them 100%, there wasn't a negotiation of like letting some other responsibilities go specifically within the home setting. So what do I mean by that? So as they were fighting for rights for women to be in the workplace and to have these opportunities, there wasn't like a renegotiation, which means yes, women were afforded through hard work all of these new responsibilities and rights and opportunities, but they still already had a full-time job for all intents and purposes within the home, meaning the majority of the child rearing, the majority of the elder care, the majority of the household responsibility still felt on the shoulders of women. So yes, they started to have more roles outside of the home, but they still carried all of the other responsibilities inside the home at the same time. So it wasn't like, okay, great, I now am going to work outside of the home, but that means now you are responsible for making Christmas magic, or you're responsible for dealing with mother-in-laws, or you are now responsible for, you know, making sure the house is tidy. Like there wasn't this renegotiation of household responsibilities, which means women are now in these other roles, which again, we appreciate, this is amazing. However, we already had these full-time jobs already looking after what feels like everybody else. and everyone. So what I think is helpful just to hold space for is that when we compare heterosexual samples, so a traditional setting where there's like a man and a woman in a household, to homosexual relationships, we actually know that there's very important conversations that happen in homosexual relationships around distribution of labor that doesn't happen in most heterosexual relationships. So meaning that if we, for example, have two women in a union, they actually talk about and negotiate and like essentially barter back and forth who's going to be responsible for what, or how are we going to do this distribution of labor. That's a conversation that happens in that particular type of relationship. That doesn't always happen in heterosexual relationships. We also see in the research that even we can take like very women that are like really big into advocating for rights, and you know they're in, it's so important their agendas and their feminist views, which are amazing. When they are entering into traditional unions such as marriages, we see a regression, meaning that they're more likely to take on a lot of this, what we call invisible labor, because that's what they were modeled with growing up. That's what they saw growing up. So it's more likely that we see this regression because that's actually what's familiar to them in terms of, quote, the role of a wife. Okay, now you're probably wondering, Robin, what does this have to do with resiliency or what we're talking about? Well, I think when we think about the load that women carry, and how much is required for women to be able to be successful, whatever we define success as, I think it's so important that we draw attention to the amount of invisible labor. Like, women literally are holding enormous amounts of information to keep a household running. And at any given time, they're required to be able to like manage it. So let me give you an example. I remember being like, almost like felt like the other side of the planet. I got a message being like, hey, you know, where are the soccer socks? And I had this moment where it's like, I was actually kind of cheesed that I actually knew where they were. Like, I wasn't anywhere in the vicinity of the area, but the ask was made. And as what we call in the house, our house, that I'm the oracle, the all-knowing where things are, I get asked for those things, right? It's like, I'm the one that gets some of those questions. And let me tell you, I don't mind it. I love being the knowledge holder. And I think it's really important just to recognize that takes up a lot of cycles. That takes up a lot of bandwidth to be the person who knows everyone's schedule, everyone's calendar, and also able to ask probably the most difficult conversation question that gets asked in households, as in, mom, what's for dinner? I tell you, that feels like a swear word. I think it was Kat and Nat that first introduced that as a swear word, but like literally, what's for dinner? Like, I never knew that when Jeff and I got into a relationship that like a good percentage of what we talk about is like, what are we going to do for dinner? Never really thought about that until you were in these situations. So again, there's this enormous amounts of invisible labor that are on the shoulders of women. Now, I hear people say, well, women are better at multitasking, or women are just like more nurturing. I call out that because we are, out of necessity. There's nothing really about us from a physiological perspective that makes us better at those things. It's learned behavior. Like, we have learned how to multitask. We have learned how to put other people's needs ahead of our own. There's nothing within our, you know, the structures of our brain that makes it that we're necessarily better at it. It's the practices of mind. And what I mean by that is the brain is like literally the, like it's the organ. Mind is the behaviors. It's the thinking, right? There's a difference between our brains and our mind. The mind has been conditioned to do it out of, yeah, for sure, necessity. And yeah, there's things that, for example, we know women do experience some differences. The classic example that I used to share with my students at the university is that women, the way that a woman hears her child cry is like a different frequency than the biological father would hear the baby cry, right? So we actually know a baby's cry is more upsetting to women from a physiological perspective. So yeah, we know that there are some biomarkers, but not that one sex is better at multitasking or being able to show up for a child who is sick, for example, than the other gender. So I think what's helpful is to recognize that there are differences in some places, but the majority of the differences that people want to ascribe to, those are just the way we are raised. It's the way that we grow up. It's what we're conditioned or really groomed to be able to do. Wow. Okay. I mean, not to be on a soapbox for this conversation, so it's not my intention, but what I do want to bring to your attention is the question, when women are carrying the weight of the world, okay, and it's literally like they feel as if they are holding it all together. They are the glue that are holding family systems, occupational systems all together. What does it look like for them to be able to, for example, look after themselves? So the big idea I want to share with you here, when I work with women, again, for most different places and spaces around the world, the number one reason why I hear women say they do not look after themselves is because when they try, they feel guilty. So let's say, for example, a woman knows like, hey, I'd love to go for a walk after work, but I feel guilty because my kids have been in school all day, or the baby's been with the nanny or the babysitter, or I haven't seen my partner or even spent some time with the dog. So I feel like I can't go make more time for myself. I feel guilty to look after myself. Or for example, you're invited to go, you know, for, you know, a cup of tea, maybe a pink tea with your friend, but you're like, oh no, I've been out of the house all day. I really should get home. There's lots of work I have to do at home. That feeling of guilt precludes a lot of women from taking care of themselves. Now let's unpack guilt for a second. And this actually reminds me of a time where I was interviewed on a podcast, and forgive me, I think I've already shared this before, but it's an oldie, but a goodie, where the interviewer asked me about my morning routine. They're like, okay, Robin, what do you do in the morning? And it's not very complex. And I shared it. It's pretty straightforward. And I can do it relatively consistently, which I'm really proud of. And they're like, wow, don't you feel guilty for spending that much time looking after you before you even like look after other people in your house? And I didn't even hesitate. I said, no, I feel guilty if I'm like short with my husband. I feel guilty if I'm like cheese with my kids, because I didn't do what I know is required for me to be able to be my best. I feel guilty if I miss that morning walk, for example, and then because I miss the morning walk and I don't get outside, and then by the end of the day, I have nothing left, my brain is fried, and I have had none of that, what we call outdorphins, right? None of those outdorphins, and then I'm short with people in my family. That's when I feel guilty. I don't feel guilty for looking after myself, because I know that's what's required to be the type of person I want to be for the people that are counting on me. So again, let's unpack the guilt. Where does it come from? I think many of us who feel guilty if we try to look after ourselves grew up in a household where we were allowed to, for example, watch TV after we finished our homework. We were allowed to go outside and play with our friends after we did our chores. So we feel guilty because we feel as though on some level we are breaking a rule. And the rule that we're breaking is I'm allowed to look after myself when all the other people are taken care of or when my job is done. So again, we feel guilty when we break a rule. What rule do we think we're breaking? The one that says you can look after you when all your work is done. My friends, I think you know, I'm confident that you know, the work is never finished. So therefore, anytime we try to take care of ourselves and there's outstanding work or tasks or responsibilities, we're going to feel not so good about it. We're going to feel bad about it. But I think that behavior needs to be unlearned. I think it's important to go like, wow, I notice I'm feeling guilty. What rule am I breaking? Oh, it's that one where I think that I have to look after everybody else first. And I think that that needs to shift to a place where looking after me is part of self-stewardship, which means I'm entrusted with this big, beautiful life. And I am responsible for looking after myself to a point where then I'm able to show up for everybody else. Now, you might remember, I shared this again earlier on an episode where we talked about that analogy about putting on the oxygen mask first, right? You might remember when you're on a plane or have heard on a plane, when they're doing the safety demo, they say, make sure to put your oxygen mask on yourself first. I remember sitting on a plane, and there just so happened to be a pilot next to me. And after the safety demo was done, I turned to the pilot and asked if I could ask a question. And I asked them, how long do you have to put on your mask? Like, I was so curious because I said, I have three children. I travel with my three children. And at times, and I said, I wanted to know how long do I have? Because if it came down to that moment, I said, I don't know if I'd be able to put it on myself first. I like to think that I would because you were instructed to, but I couldn't do something for myself at the risk of my kids. I'd always put it on my kids first. And the pilot said something that was so significant. 10 seconds, maybe at best, but likely under 10 seconds. He said, maybe 5 seconds. He said, if this cabin loses its pressure, he said, like seconds, you'll have seconds to put on that oxygen mask. And he said, if you care about your family, if you care about your kids, you're damn well going to put it on yourself first. Now, the reason I'm sharing that again is it is not selfish to look after ourselves. It is science. It is the science of our physiology, it's our science of our biology. We need to be able to look after ourselves. And that doesn't make us, again, selfish people. It makes us people that are wise because we know one of the greatest predictors of a child's resiliency. Okay, I hope you're listening to this because this is such a goodie. The greatest predictor of a child's resiliency is the well-being of the mother, their primary caregiver. The greatest chance of a child being resilient after they've gone through trauma, have gone through grief, gone through whatever life throws at them, is the health of their primary caregiver. If mom's okay, child will be okay. If mom is not okay, it's going to be a lot harder for that child to be okay. We want to make sure that we are looking after the people that are holding our families together. And that's why, for example, in developing countries that we see, educating mothers is one of the greatest ways to ignite social change. Because when the mothers are educated, it's going to make a difference for their families. Okay, so we're going to look after ourselves. We're going to acknowledge the guilt we sometimes feel, and we are going to feel the guilt and do it anyway, look after ourselves anyway. So again, where are you going to get a good return on your investment? Let's say you don't have a lot of time, you're carrying the weight of the world. First of all, let's just acknowledge how remarkable it is that you are in this position or this role or have the gift of the responsibility of being a primary person, right? Like I think that's so special in itself. This isn't a sentence. Like this literally for some of us is our vocation that we get to be somebody's somebody. And I shared that before the day that I got to when Hunter was born. That morning, when I'm holding this little baby, I was like, I have never wanted to be somebody's someone as bad as I wanted to be that for that little guy. And then, obviously, subsequently, his brother and his sister as well. So we acknowledge and we can love it that we have these roles and dual truth. It can be exhausting, it can be a lot, and both can be true at the same time. So, having said that, what are some of the things, the little grab and go takeaways for us? I want you to think about it this way. Could I do something today for my head? Something that's going to give me clarity, something that's going to give me like this idea of just like knowing what matters most to make it matter most. Like, what is something that I can literally do for my brain? Maybe it's tidying up my space. Maybe it is writing down that to-do list. Maybe it's a few moments of solitude. Maybe it's like listening to my favorite song that helps me kind of process emotion, whatever it is, something for your head that's going to give you clarity, or maybe a nap, maybe a facial, whatever, just whatever that thing is for your head. And then something for your heart. What is something that you can do for your heart to just like make sure that your heart feels like you're connected with it? Something that makes you feel that feeling of fondness, something to get that oxytocin flowing through your bloodstream. And lastly, one thing for your body. And it could be something, again, that non-negotiable 30-minute walk, no matter what. Or maybe it could be skipping the walk because today you need to actually just be really tender. And maybe you'll just do like a little bit of stretching or just something that's going to help your body feel nourished, rested, whatever that might be. So something for your head, right? Something for your mind, something for your heart, and then something for your body. If you do just one thing each day for that, for those parts, I think it gives us some clarity on how it is that we can feel well and be well while we're looking after the wellness of the world and our families. The other little last one, and I think it was Jenna, my teammate, who flagged this for me. She showed me a meme where it was something to the effect of like women going for their walks, but then like wearing the weighted vest. And I'm a huge advocate of using a weighted vest, especially if you're doing it at like 45, like I'm 45. So 45 onwards, lots of great research about how it can really protect our bones. There's lots of good research why weighted vests are important. But I also think it's good to recognize that when like women are already carrying the weight of the world on their shoulders, maybe the extra 12 pounds isn't necessary today. So again, being gentle with yourself in terms of what your needs are, recognize that you come from this long line of women who are cheering you on. You are still being cheered on by your ancestors. When you ask the universe for help, listen to the fact that you are going to have aunties and grandmothers and mothers who are there cheering you on, rooting for you. And just, I imagine them being just so awe-inspired by what's available to women in 2025. Yes, there's a lot of work that still needs to be done, but I believe that there are aunties and grandmothers and great-grandmothers that are cheering us on from up beyond. Because what it's like to be a woman in 2025, yes, there are challenges and struggles, but also like women are the force behind the economy right now. Like women are carrying on the next generation of women and men. And just, again, there's so much power. There is so much power when we show up together, when we cheer each other on. And the last kind of little idea to land this plane is the notion, I've shared it before, is that women at the bottom are competing. Women at the top are collaborating. Women at the top are absolutely collaborating. And speaking of collaborations, I want to give a special shout out to my dear friend, Natalie, who is in the East Coast of Canada. And she is such a remarkable woman. She is a woman of all these different skill sets. And I got so curious because I wanted to learn from her. And so I remember a little while ago, I reached out and I'd be like, Natalie, I want to learn with you. Like, I don't know what that looks like, but are you open to learning? Like, I want to learn with you because I love what you're doing. And she responded and she's like, yeah, well, hey, you're doing stuff I want to learn about too. So in that moment, we like create this little bit of like, I referred to it as like the prison bartering system where I share information, she shares information with me, and knowledge is the currency. And again, I just want to create places and spaces where women can get into those exchanges of currency, whether that be knowledge, whether it be wisdom, whatever you want to call it. So if there's someone that you're really inspired by, ask, reach out, see if there's a place for you in that space where you can be, again, that prison brokering system. I probably shouldn't use a prison brokering system. There's probably a better way to call it something else, but like that exchange, that bartering, brokering, whatever that might be. Or again, if there's someone you want to learn from, ask, because I really believe that if we come together, it's going to be remarkable how much we can accelerate the learning and continue to elevate for ourselves, but also for our sons and our daughters. So as we sign off on this idea about International Women's Day, I just want to give a huge recognition and shout out to so many amazing women in my life. But at the end of the day, the woman who makes this all possible was my late mother, Leslie. And I do this all for my Ava Leslie. So to my girls, I love you. I celebrate you. To everyone listening, thanks for being here. And I hope there's a moment in the next few kind of minutes that you can reach out to one of those powerful women who have been cheering you on, who've been in your corner, and just say thank you and maybe have a cup of pink tea. Thanks for listening. Bye. Thank you for spending time with this podcast episode today. I hope you found something helpful in Resiliency Redefined. Please feel free to share it with somebody who you might think could benefit. Maybe there was something useful, something in particular that you think you could pay forward. Also, if you have a moment, please feel free to rate and review this podcast wherever you like to listen to your podcast. It means the world to me. And again, thanks for your time. Thank you for your interest. Take good care, and I'll see you next time.